Hello, everyone. I'm Charlemagne Palestine. I'm born in Brooklyn, New York, but now, since over 20 years, I'm a resident of Brussels. And I'm here with Richard Harris, who's in my Charlotte world, which is a big hangar in Evere that I have with all my objects and divinities and elements and instruments, etc. When I was around 11 and 12, I lived in a part of Brooklyn then. It's not like Brooklyn now. There was just nothing happening, and I was a very curious young kid, and I started early to take the subway and go into Greenwich Village. In those days, there were like four or five coffee houses that had evening performances for poets and writers and all kinds of strange beatnik people hanging out. And so I hung out in several of the, and as it was coffee, I was permitted to be there at 11 and 12 years old. And so I had bought some bongo drums in a shop, and I was carrying it around with me, wearing sunglasses and beret, and sort of acting like a little beatnik. And a whole lot of what turned out to be legendary artists, poets, and just personages liked me, and I became sort of the mascot of a whole generation of crazies. And I was their bongo man, would say better, bongo boy.
Now, at the same age, or maybe a little bit later, you were carillonneur at St. Thomas Episcopal for a number of years.
7 years.
How did that happen?
7 years. Well, I was selling marijuana outside of the High School of Music and Art to some of my student friends. I had found an older guy. I became his seller because I looked so innocent, and no one would imagine that I would be selling marijuana right outside the door, which I did for a while. And my girlfriend at the time got very worried that I would get caught and be put in prison, and she tried to find me another job. And her father happened to know this guy who played the bells next to the Museum of Modern Art at St. Thomas Episcopal Church, and he was looking for someone who could take over for him. And so she organized a meeting, and I immediately took to the instrument, but in a crazy way. But this guy called Richard Beatty, he found it really amazing that I was so radical already in 5 minutes with this instrument that was a very ancient instrument and very stiff because it belonged to the church like organs are. And so he hired me. And as the church was right next to, it still is, right next to the Museum of Modern Art, I didn't make a lot of money, but I had a membership card for 7 years to MoMA. You could hear my musics in the sculpture garden in those days. And so I started to come down to 53rd Street and 5th Avenue all the time. I played right across the street from CBS because finally the church began to find that my musics were much too outrageous for their taste. And they were going to fire me. And it turned out that the president of CBS, whose office was right on my bells, turned out that he adored my playing. I eventually even did the trademark for all CBS broadcasting documentary films of the 60s. My bell music was their trademark opening for all these. And he went to the church and complained. And then I never had problem ever again. And I remained the Quasimodo of Fifth Avenue till in the early 70s. I left New York City to go to the California Institute of the Art.
You have been described as one of the founders of minimalism, but I read that you prefer to call yourself a maximalist. Well, is there a contradiction there?
I never used that word. That was a word that came out of visual arts. I have to always tell this story. And Tom Johnson, he was writing for the Village Voice in those years, 73, 74, and he coined the term, which was until then was being used by visual art, minimal art, reductive minimal art, and began to use that for what many of us were doing using drones and modes and musics that were more sonorous and melodic than a lot of the music that had come right before, like Xenakis, Stockhaus, Pierre Boulez. So he coined the term one day that this is a kind of minimal music. And it became a term that they began to use for a whole generation of musicians. But I always hated the term from the beginning, and I never used that term. I used trance, I used continuums, I used drone, the actual term like you might use in India. I called them drones. But the term minimal just seemed to me like nothing to do with the approach of which I particularly dealt with sounds or anything, as you can see in my world around. I'm an excessivist, but sometimes I use only several elements to its excess. So around the 2000s, I started to call myself, like, officially a maximalist. And that took a long time for it to sort of, like, enter. People thought I was sort of joking. But last year, I heard an interview on the BBC of Phil Glass, and he now calls himself a maximalist.
So the Spectral Continuum drone machine, what was that?
Oh, that was a machine. Well, I worked as I came in the generation of American electronic, because I started early in electronic music. There were four or five different inventors in those days who were developing machines in between California, which was Donald Buchla, the Buchla synthesizer, and then his disciple, we could say, which was Serge Cherepnin, that became eventually the do-it-yourself synthesizer, the most famous one of the 70s and early 80s, the Serge. And then on the East Coast, there was Bob Moog, who from the Theremin created the Moog synthesizer. And then there was ARP, which was a very important company with Irv Tybell and a few other people. And I became the sort of guinea pig, the cabay, of those, all those people, as well as some other young composers, where they would have us go and play their machines, and then we would give them advice as to how the machine might work better, because all those, very few of those inventors actually were composers themselves. So they needed advice. So I became an advisor, and through that, I had Serge and Buchla and ARP all helped me to make a kind of a drone machine, which became the Spectral Continuum drone machine, which still exists. It was just recently restored by Floris van Hoff and a couple of other young Belgian composer engineering people for electronics. And now it works again. And it still makes some very beautiful drones. Now Casio has a little organ that I use. I have about 40 of them. These little Casio organs that cost 65 euros a piece, and they can do all kinds of the most stable and detune and amazing things for 65 euros each. And it's a little organ, so you can actually play. It's like an accordion organ. But in those days, these were all very experimental things.
We're sitting here in this studio of yours, and we're surrounded by thousands and thousands of different stuffed animals. And you call them your divinities.
Mm. I used to do these very long drone pieces that sometimes lasted for days. But if I had some divinity animals, what I call them, placed somewhere in space, one could imagine that they were very, very concentrated and absorbing all of this sound event in total Zen Nirvana phase. They remained in their continuumness forever, as they do, because they are inanimate. But somehow, in the world that I've tried to develop over the last 50 years, they are animate inanimates. So it was a kind of shamanic. But also, it goes back to the invention of the teddy bear, which is invented by a Jewish couple in 1902 in Brooklyn, around 5 kilometers from where I'm born, by a couple who are from the same region in Eastern Europe, near to Lithuania and Belarus, that my mother's family, who were also into textiles, came from. And so we could say that this is sort of like a kind of secular Jewish totem, the teddy bear. And so I sometimes like to say that the teddy bear, or the stuffed animal, is my cousin. It's part of my family. And so there's also aesthetics, the continuum, long listening, but then textiles, which we call shmatas. Shmata is a kind of a chiffon, or a rag, that Jews find very important, because we weren't permitted to be a member of guilds in the Middle Ages, and so we only could reuse things like rag. So we were called rag merchants in those days, and the word that is a Jewish word for that is shmata. That these, all these creatures are shmata divinities, meaning that they've already been used and discarded, which is also important. I like that, because parents are afraid to use them again because they're not sure if they're disinfected, or so they are an objecta non grata.
For instance, the Shmetrospective that you did at Beaux-Arts, What is your method of work? How do you create all those rooms?
I had a team, a fabulous team. Everybody loved working on the show, which made it even better. And I've had good luck in that sense, is that people who are working on my shows love working on my shows. And so the shows get better because I have such positive relationship with all my people who collaborate with me.
You went from Brooklyn to Manhattan to California to Brussels.
That's right.
Why Brussels?
Well, first of all, as I said, I went to Europe. There was a better audience here in Europe than there was in America for experimental works. There still is. There are many more outlets. Here in Europe, there are like in every, or in the early days, in the 70s when I first came, it wasn't in every town, but all different towns had their own like art scene, commercial and non-commercial. And so it was a great place for artists like us from New York, from California, to develop our work in Europe. Lots in the Netherlands, lots in Italy, Germany, Belgium. In the 70s, Belgium was very active in arts coming from other places, especially New York. So that's why I began gradually from the 70s till now to live more and more regularly in Europe and then come back to New York. And finally, I was living in the late 80s. I was then finally living in the middle of France between Lyon and Saint-Étienne. Then I was living, invited to work in projects in Utrecht and Rotterdam. And while I was living in Utrecht and Rotterdam, I used to pass here in Brussels because I had some close friends already, still from the 70s. When I was doing anything in living in Holland and come doing a project in France, I'd have to pass anyway. Brussels, I'd come and stop. And in some of these times, I met my wife, and we eventually got together, and now we're together for 21 years. And so that's how I came to live in Brussels, and now in Belgium.